Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. A few years ago, I think I saw one of the most sort of arresting documentaries, mainstream documentaries, that I've seen by the British documentarian Adam Curtis, called The Century of the Self. It was older than that, but I didn't get around to it for a while. And it talks about the construction of our modern sense of subjectivity, who we are, how we make decisions, how we desire things. And it offered a somewhat unsettling notion, which is that while we think of propaganda to be something that happens maybe at the far levels of political extremity or in times of war, that really something like propaganda has been going on all the way through the 20th century, and that our very sense of self is in some ways a product of this process. And one aspect of this, of Adam Curtis's story, which went into the history of public relations, of advertising, of media, of propaganda for wartime, was the idea that right after World War II, there was a very strong awareness of something that we might call the authoritarian personality type. This is the idea that there are certain kinds of people, certain ways of being human that lend themselves to being manipulated in a fascist environment. So it's less about the authoritarians themselves, the Hitlers, the Mussolinis, the other demagogues, than it is about the populations, the masses, so to speak. And we always got to remember that the whole idea of the masses, of which we are both part and not really quite a part individually, is really part of this whole story of the 20th century political personality consciousness. And the idea was that, put forward by Curtis, is that many people developed an idea about what this authoritarian personality type was and decided to, in a wide variety of ways that have had much more impact on us than we might acknowledge, created in the post-war environment a number of mechanisms, tools, ideologies, practices, and ideas that helped produce the alternative. The post-war democratic personality, a personality who, instead of entering into a identification with some kind of fascist, violent state ideology, would instead identify with the kind of open, post-war American model dominated by ideas of free trade, of tolerance, democracy, et cetera, and that this, in turn, has sort of really shaped our sense of self, not just as political entities, but psychologically, internally, and that a lot of the behaviors we see now, and of course this story needs to be updated in the age of the internet, but that this whole story is really in some ways a backbone of 20th century consciousness. And I picked up this story here and there and other places, and it always sort of bugged me a little bit because it felt tantalizingly gestured towards in Curtis's documentary, but not really fleshed out in the way that I wanted to. And so while I highly recommend The Century of the Self, I'm extremely pleased to say that Fred Turner's new book, The Democratic Surround, more or less answers this question. He goes into precisely this story, and in a way which is particularly interesting for people who have read or enjoyed, perhaps on this show, talks with Fred about his previous book, From Counterculture to Cyberculture, which was really a significant piece of modern historical writing because it showed connections that most people were not aware of or had forgotten, and that really have a great deal of influence and importance for our concurrent wrestling with the politics of consciousness. And that book, which again we interviewed Fred about a couple years ago on this show. He showed how, contrary to the popular idea, which is that the hippies and the counterculture were anti-technology, they were only seeking a more organic, back-to-nature life, and that technology and computers was entirely associated with the system or the establishment, that instead there were all sorts of more nuanced and interesting ways that the counterculture attempted to remake the idea of technology, remake the idea of technologically enabled communities and collectives, and that these ideas, which were, you know, in the stew at the time through things like the Holler's catalog and Stuart Brand's whole career, and even earlier with the Merry Pranksters, with systems ideas that permeated the Esalen and the New Age, that these ideas really went front and center into the emergence of West Coast, Bay Area oriented in many ways, cyberculture, and that a lot of the rhetoric we hear now about, you know, that's sort of drawing us into the sticky web of Google and Apple and these other, you know, global mind corporations, really derives in a lot of ways from this ethos, from a countercultural ethos. And he traces the story with the accuracy and close attention of a true historian in a way that Adam Curtis was more sort of suggestive and rhetorical. And in the new book, The Democratic Surround, which is equally fun to read, it's a little bit older historically, he pretty much shows the sort of pre-story, the things that lead up to this cybercultural or countercultural emergence, and really talks about the 1940s, the 1950s, and the early 1960s that kind of sets the stage for this whole evolution. So it's a wonderful book, and I think a very important one. And since Maja is not joining us today, we'll just bring Fred on and talk about the Democratic Surround, and hopefully at the end a little bit of a where we are question. So, Fred, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric. Great to be here.
Yeah. I also wanted to say that you're an associate professor in the Department of Communications at Stanford, so we can get those official status bona fides out there. But I am curious. I mean, you're from counterculture to cyberculture, you know, really struck a nerve. People liked it. It was read probably more. I mean, I'm sure you had high hopes for it, but it was read, you know, quite broadly. A lot of people talked about it. And then you're sitting there going, okay, what am I going to do next? People are so interested in, you know, questions of cyberculture, where we are now, the internet, blah, blah, blah. Why did you choose to kind of, in a way, go the other direction, go back in time to the 1940s?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I was really surprised when I was working on the counterculture book how much the people of the counterculture, Stuart Brand and his set, actually owed to ideas and writers and thinkers from the 40s and 50s. I was always told that the generation of the 1960s was a rebellious generation. It had overthrown what had been a kind of black and white, father knows best set of decades. And what surprised me when I was reading a lot of counterculture literature and talking to folks from that era was how much they owed to a vision of a liberal, wide open, sexually tolerant, racially pluralist America that actually was right in the middle of the liberal ideal of the 40s and 50s. I just hadn't known that existed. And so as I thought about a new project to kind of get underway with, I started digging into that history, and the world that bubbled up just shocked me with its radicalness and with its hopes for just a really different kind of America than we have now.
Well, one of the things I really liked about the book, the way it, you know, the way that sometimes you can read historical accounts that even if they're not trying to rewrite the, you know, the major flows of history, do actually shift your sort of core mythology about what happened in certain decades. And this book really did it for me because of around the 1940s and the 1950s. And again, this idea, it's so easy to have this model of the 50s is buttoned down, organizational man,
yep,
at best a sort of hedonism through stupid consumerism and gadgets for the kitchen, a real bummer, restrictive, sexually repressed, and then the hippies happen and it's a whole, you know, different,
yep,
ballgame. And you're really showing that there were very liberal, even, you know, kind of radical in implication, if not politically, ideas that were that were already bubbling up, and in a lot of ways, and this is the part where it really makes sense, where it really goes, oh, I get it, is that all of this stuff happens in response to fascism, in response to World War II and to this kind of terrifying spectacle of propaganda, of the use of media, the use of radio by Hitler to draw together the mass into this, like, seething beast of fearsome nationalism, almost with a kind of messianic or religious, a kind of irrational character, and that this really freaked people out, and they were like, what are we going to do? So that was also very illuminating for me. Can you talk a little bit more about this idea of the authoritarian personality and where that came from, which in some way seems to set up this kind of liberal personality that comes next?
Absolutely. Let's start with 1939 and 1940. You know, we tend to think of fascism today as a threat from overseas, something that came alive in Italy and Germany and Japan. In 1939 and 1940, fascism was a very real possibility here at home. You know, we've forgotten that in 1939, 22,000 Americans rallied in Madison Square Garden on behalf of fascism. We had a march, 1,000 people marching down East 86th Street without being protested, after Hitler went into Poland, marching down the street with swastikas and American flags. We had Father Coughlin on the airwaves, 3.5 million listeners every week. Gallup poll shows that 60% of them agree with his proto-fascist views. So my point is that the fear of fascism is very real in the U.S. at that point, and the fear that these kind of fascist people are among us is very real. And alongside that, there's a fear that mass media, movies, radio, newspapers, quite literally turn us into fascists. They somehow trigger our unconscious and take a perfectly reasonable person and turn them into an authoritarian. So the authoritarian is someone who is out of touch with their reason, unable to make rational decisions, but somehow in touch with an unconscious desire to meld into a mass and to obey a distant leader. Mass media in this period trigger the idea, at least in theory, trigger this kind of unconscious desire to follow the leader. And so in 1939 and 1940, American intellectuals and American political leaders are desperate to find a way to inspire our own people to go to war against fascism without using mass media and without turning them into fascists. And that's arguably the origin of multimedia. It's a place where theories of the democratic personality bubble up, and it's where the idea that if we surround people with multiple screens, multiple sound sources, and free them to explore themselves within that space, we will end up with a different kind of person and a different kind of country. That difference is what takes us ultimately to the 60s.
Yeah, this is you know, I can't wait to ask you about this media, but before we leave it, I'm curious, and I bet many of our listeners are, is that I know it's a little bit off the field, but can you just say a little bit about where did these American fascists come from? I mean, it kind of blows my mind that they would. I mean, I know there were some elements of that. There's always been that element in the right wing, at least through the 20th century. But you're talking about something a little bit more, with a little more momentum and a little bit more direct identification with, let's say, German fascism in the late 30s. What's going on there? Where does that come from?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think people at the time were mystified as well. I think there's two different answers. One answer is the narrow answer, that many of the people in the New York fascist movement were connected to the German-American Bund, which is a kind of German-American friendship organization. It actually ran Nazi summer camps on Long Island in 39, completely forgotten. But fascism was spread more widely across the nation at that time. Life magazine actually did, as I remember, about 8 stories on American fascists between 38 and 40. So it was widely known at the time, widely forgotten since. So if the answer isn't the Bund, or isn't only the Bund, I think the other answer is the answer that we see in Germany at the same moment. Both Weimar Germany and Depression-era America go through a period of extraordinary political and economic chaos. People feel really abandoned and at sea. And in that context, I think there's, you know, a central political leader has enormous appeal. In his time, Franklin Roosevelt was in fact frequently called a fascist and lined up with Hitler and Mussolini as a centralized and centralizing political force, which in retrospect looks kind of funny. But at the time, people were afraid that he might build a kind of central government apparatus like the one that we saw emerging in Germany and Italy. The appeal of that apparatus, I think, comes from the tremendous chaos of the Depression here and the interwar years in Germany.
Yeah, that makes sense. It also reminds me of the sort of the right wing icon of Obama with a Hitler mustache. It's a kind of resurrection of some of that fear of the sort of democratic and not socialist kind of American political leader who still actually holds within him the seeds of this fascist kind of demagogue. So in response to this, in some ways quite consciously, a network of intellectuals, of psychologists, of people working with media, people, political thinkers. And we always have to remember that the category of intellectuals had a much greater influence at this period of time in American history than they do today. There was much more flexibility moving between the academy, public discourse, government, and so that when we talk about intellectuals, not a bunch of guys in a university lab somewhere. These are people who really have force. Is that they come up with this sort of notion of a democratic personality type? What's that?
The democratic personality is a fascinating one, developed by the psychologist Gordon Allport and a number of other thinkers and brought forward into something called the Committee for National Morale in 1940. The Committee for National Morale included figures like Margaret Mead, Ruth Benedict, Gordon Allport, who was a psychologist from Harvard, a refugee German psychologist named Kurt Lewin. These folks were psychologically and culturally radical. They were drawing on an idea that the personalities of the individual citizens of a country were, in fact, the root source of that country's cultural style. And so if we were going to have a democratic society, boy, we had better think about what a democratic personality was. And the democratic personality was one who was essentially wide open. So Gordon Allport wrote in 1942, he said, every personality can be a citadel of resistance to tyranny in a democracy. And to be a citadel of resistance to tyranny, you had to be able to choose things freely. You had to be able to appreciate and value diversity. You had to allow others to be themselves, even as you pursued your own individual validating projects. You had to be collaborative without being domineering. And those characteristics were very, very powerful and very widely shared in that period in the sort of the social theory of that period. The other thing to remember is that for the thinkers of the 1940s, early 1940s, 40, 41, they had the Nazis as a dark backdrop against which to cast all of their ideas. So if Hitler said, turn your mind off and follow me, the democratic personality had to be one that left its reason on and followed its own dictates. Ruth Benedict, likewise, wrote a tremendously powerful attack on American race and racialism in response to the German assertion that, in fact, German society was based on racial difference. The Germans became a sort of backstop against which we began to imagine ourselves as tolerant, collaborative, flexible, independent individuals working together toward a common end, but still individuals.
It's actually interesting to think about when you think about the history of racism in America, because America's been robustly racist in many ways. Mm-hmm. That at this moment it might even have been the case that the idea of not being racist, of embracing diversity, may have been stronger than it would have been otherwise because of the example, this quite just incontrovertibly horrendous example of German racism.
I think that's exactly right, and I think there's another piece too that we've also tended to forget, which is the rise of the call for sexual pluralism and sexual diversity. I think we often imagine that the closet predated everything until Stonewall in 69, and that's not actually true. Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict were lovers as well as colleagues. In the circles that I write about, sexual flexibility, intellectual flexibility are very, very common. People are out without necessarily being out very, very visibly. Even as they're calling for a new kind of racial tolerance, they're also calling for the tolerance of a sexual diversity that is very powerful. And, just as the call for racial diversity, I think, in many ways predates and sets up the civil rights movement, so does the call for sexual diversity, even in it goes on into the early 1950s, predate and help set up the world of Stonewall and the gay rights movements to come.
Yeah, that's really, it also makes me think of, I mean, in a less political vein, but the example of Aldous Huxley, whose world was very much open to these things. His you know, has an open relationship with his wife, who is mostly a lesbian, and this is just sort of part of this world, this kind of experimental but also very intellectually informed world that you find in the kind of interstices of America in the 1940s. But bringing up his example also because part of the kind of influence of the idea of the people behind the idea of the democratic personality also had to do with another factor coming from World War II, which is that Europeans, many of them intellectually and artistically advanced Europeans, came to America in droves and had their own impact on America's resistance to fascism and its sort of reconstruction of its personality type, of its destiny even.
I think that's right, and I think that there's another piece to it which is kind of funny, which is so in the book I tell the story of the American intellectuals who are theorizing a kind of multimedia that will free and enable this democratic personality to enter American life and become the basis of American unity. The trouble is the intellectuals don't make media. So they're coming up with all kinds of good theories, and they're mostly in New York and Chicago. Lucky for them, there is a whole slew of unemployed former Bauhaus artists who've all come to the United States, who are all refugees from Hitler's Germany, and who bring with them really robust theories of multimedia and multimedia design. At the same time, they need work. And they've had ideas of kind of liberating the self in a German context that they can now translate into ideas of liberating the self in an American context. So they begin to build multimedia environments that quite literally create new democratic people, as once formerly in Weimar, they hope to create a kind of new German man in the 20s and 30s. And these are people like Herbert Beyer. Beyer goes on to help found the Aspen Institute and create the Aspen that we know today. Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, the photographer and designer. Walter Gropius, we know more about. Folks like that.
And so what is their background? I mean, what are the kind of, if they're, before they sort of cross and encounter and meld purposes to some degree with this political notion of the democratic personality, what are their influences? I mean, you know, Bauhaus, not just as a design expression, but as really a theory of living or another way of thinking about the self in a modern context. Where are these guys coming from on that score?
I've always thought of the Bauhaus as a kind of group of artistic technocrats. You know, they come into being about 1920 in Germany. They're stationed at Dessau and then at Weimar. And they believe that if they can create an artist's design space in which they train artists and designers in each of the many skills that go into art and design across the board, they will produce a kind of new, holistically capable artist and designer who will themselves also be a newly whole kind of person. They were operating under the theory that industrial society, and especially the Weimar Germany of the 1920s, had a fracturing impact on the German psyche. And their job, they thought, was to expose individual people to multiple art forms, to allow them to practice those art forms together, and so become both more whole artists and more whole people in the face of industrial psychological impacts. That notion that art can make you whole, that the appreciation of diverse experiences knit together and acted out makes you a whole person, that's what they bring over with them. They bring it from an economically chaotic place to a place that feels under political threat, and they turn what was a sort of economic idea of making a person whole to resist industrial life into a political one, turning a person whole and democratic so as to resist fascism.
And then this idea gets expressed through multimedia environments. Now, when you say multimedia to me, you know, I think of the last 20 years. I don't think of I barely think of the 1960s, although I know about the happenings and the human being and the idea of these kind of diverse environments, but I'm certainly not thinking of the late 1940s. So what are some concrete examples of the influential kinds of multimedia that these artists came up with that sort of help propagate this idea of a more tolerant figure who's open to diversity but still individualist and able to work collaboratively with others?
Great. So let me start actually with one that wasn't actually built, but set the stage for many others. In June of 1940, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, led by Abby Rockefeller, designed an entirely new building under the heading Exhibition X. It was a sort of top secret project. And the building was to be a three-dimensional experiential space through which groups of the public were to be taken. They were to have automated taped voices speaking to them from the walls, from hidden places in the walls, hidden speakers. They were to go through different rooms of different sizes, with different colors, different textures, different lightings, different smells and sounds. They were to see the classics of American history, so the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, illuminated. They were to watch movies, to encounter talking mannequins and motion pictures. All of this was designed to place these citizens in a space where they could select from all kinds of different sounds, smells, and images those that were most meaningful to themselves. And they were thereby to become more individuated, both more American and more individuated. And, you know, the folks who designed this building contrasted it with movies. Movies were a one-to-many experience. You put a screen up on the wall, everybody sits and watches the screen together. That situation, people at the time thought was fascist. Now, ironically, Abby Rockefeller, who's running the Museum of Modern Art at this period and funding it, decided not to build Exhibition X because she felt that it was too domineering, too cinematic, and ultimately too fascist. And so the idea that was Exhibition X bubbles out through all kinds of places. At the museum in the 1940s, it becomes multi-image photography shows with the photographs hung above the person on the ceiling, hung on the wall, hung on the floor. They become places where there are hundreds of images selected by Edward Steichen, in this case, a famous photographer and propagandist from the period, designed by Herbert Beyer, the Bauhaus artist, to surround individuals with images of a patriotic America, images from which that person could select. It then travels out of World War II in two very different ways. In one way, the multi-image sort of exhibition style of these photo shows becomes the basis of America's overseas trade show propaganda. It travels all through the 50s, right up into the early 1960s. Then, in a totally other direction, it migrates out through the Bauhaus figures to people like John Cage. So John Cage starts taking apart sound. He has a radically new idea of what sound should be. We should not have hierarchical music, no more harmony, no more dictatorial Beethovens, note the Germanic overtones there. Rather, we should simply surround people with the sounds that are in the world and let them knit those together into a meaningful experience of their own. Cage's turn, which is very much a turn he takes while he's actually working with these Bauhaus figures, becomes the basis of an entirely new aesthetic that runs up through the counterculture, through Black Mountain College, through Robert Rauschenberg's paintings, through the first happenings, which is in 1952 at Black Mountain College, all the way up into the psychedelia of the 1960s. Here's the weirdest thing.
Yeah,
before we get into that,
there's a lot of stuff to open up sure. There, and it's wonderful to place these figures in this larger story. Just a more contemporary response is that, again, hearing this story, especially like the contrast between these potential museum exhibitions and cinema, I can't help just thinking of the sort of congratulatory rhetoric of all these information devices and interactive communities today. It's like we're replaying the same moment over half a century later, where it's like, oh, the old media is domineering and the film, and you don't want to just sit there. You want to respond. You want to make your own. Enter a game. Join a fan community. And the sort of praise of the interactivity of so many media making and culture weaving machines today is really, in a way, a kind of just a rerun of this story that you're telling.
I very much agree. And there's a deep, deep cultural irony here. You know, on the one hand, the kind of media environment that you describe, highly interactive, individuated, one with lots and lots of media choices and lots of sources, you know, iPads, iPods, your cell phone, the big screen. That world was the world that the Committee for National Morale was hoping to create, because in 1940, it looked incredibly liberating when it was set against the image of fascism. The trouble is, that turn also, I think, gave rise to a deeply managerial aesthetic and a deeply managerial way of organizing society. the Democratic Surround, on the one hand, is a freeing space. You get to not be locked in a crowd watching a movie. You get to move around and select images that are meaningful to you. But it's also a highly managed space, and the managers are off stage. They've built the world through which you move, and you may feel free within it, but your selections have, in fact, been prearranged. You live in a kind of world where somebody else has aggregated the possibilities. And that's the world we inhabit now. We inhabit a world where we have many choices, but the choices have in many ways been made for us elsewhere before we even get to encounter them.
Well, I totally want to drill down on this question because I think you're actually your account really helps us understand a lot of what's going on, both of what's actually happening behind the scenes, but also reasons that people feel paranoid and fearful about the situation we're in, but also have no real way of thinking about what's going on. I think there's a real good explanation for some of our current political paranoia there and technological paranoia. But we got to take a break first. So you're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Fred Turner about his book, The Democratic Surround, and we'll be right back in just a few moments. Welcome back to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Fred Turner about the Democratic Surround. And before the break, Fred, you were telling me about how these sort of new media environments and really a whole new philosophy of media and communication emerged in response to this idea of an authoritarian or fascist personality, and one that really emphasized openness, interactivity, tolerance for diversity, but also an emphasis on making your own way, on your own kind of process of individuation, of turning yourself into a unique individual as you move through these environments. And you made the point that while on the one hand this is a very almost kind of a utopian or a very very positive, freeing notion, and there are, clearly are lots of wonderful things about it, that it also produces this kind of irony that behind the scenes there are the managers, the technologists, the media designers, the programmers, who are in some sense setting up the environment behind the scenes, and so we're asked to sort of be free within this context, which in some cases is in a lot of ways is kind of set up and reconstructed constructed. And what this really suggests to me is it really resonates with something that I've been quite interested in, which is to really track some of the very sobering and at its extreme conspiratorial ideas sort of around this idea, both back in the day, but particularly as we bring it forward into our current, media-saturated environment, where our media companies and their advertising and the rhetoric you read in newspapers is very much along very, very similar lines. Consume, become an individual, be tolerant of other people's consumption. We're moving through this diverse space where you get to remix your own reality, et cetera, et cetera. And yet there's this creeping, disturbing feeling that the whole thing is kind of set up. And when Google invites me to like move through Google Plus and like things and share my own process of moving through information space, it's of course using that data to for its own devices that have nothing to do with me. The whole thing is kind of a setup in a way, and yet I'm asked to sort of discover myself through this maze. And I want to ask you about that tension, but first I just want to read one quotation in your book, something that I had heard about years ago, but I'd never actually read, which really kind of embodies this kind of more conspiratorial view. This is from Gregory Bateson, an anthropologist, an early cybernetics thinker, who was one of these intellectuals working on this problem of creating a kind of democratic personality and thinking about it. And he has this kind of ominous, unintentionally, no doubt, but ominous quotation where he says, "We may be able to get a more definite and more operational definition of such habits as free will if we ask about each, what sort of experimental learning context would we devise in order to inculcate this habit, in order to generate the sense of free will? How should we rig the maze or problem box so that the anthropomorphic rat, that is, human beings, shall obtain a repeated and reinforced impression of his own free will. I mean, I hear that's Google right there, and I just love to hear you riff on that. I mean, you've studied this stuff both today and in the past. Like, it's a big deal. How have you come to think about this balance of the democratic freedom and this kind of behind the scenes managerial control?
Well, thank you for calling it out. And I found myself very much in the position that you found yourself, being called in by Google in different ways and, you know, just becoming so frustrated and finding that the only way I could think about it was, in fact, to go back into the past and try to find where it had come from. You know, for someone like Bateson, the turn to rigging the maze is the alternative to being the Minotaur, to sort of being, you know, the fascist figure who eats everything around them. So he thinks of it as liberating. And I think one thing we forget is that in the 40s and 50s, management wasn't yet a bad word. Management was the alternative to top-down hierarchical abuse of folks. The trouble is that management is itself a mode of control. And I think there's a couple of issues with it in that moment that resonate in ours. The first is so obvious it's hard to even talk about, and that is that the radical emphasis on individuals and individual self-formation makes it very difficult for individuals to come together and form the kinds of institutions that actually lead to political and social change. The institutional work of these surrounds is always done off stage. It's done by the people who set the stage, who put the pictures up. It's the museum owners. It's the propaganda exhibition builders. It's not the people who actually attend the place. The second thing is that the work that goes into helping individuals produce themselves in this period is always, in the 40s and 50s, monitored and reported back. My favorite examples of these are overseas. You know, in 1956, we actually created an exhibition in Afghanistan in which we created a Buckminster Fuller Dome, a geodesic dome, filled it with images and objects from America, sent illiterate Afghans in to see it, and then when they came back out, we tested them using pictures that we had drawn of Afghan responses to see if they had, in fact, had their psychologies changed. To take this to the paranoid side, I had a very sort of paranoia-inducing moment in the archives, in the United States Information Agency archives in Maryland, where I actually found a document. It was a declassified document laying out in the late 50s the American policy of what I've come to call therapeutic nationalism. This document said that what we need to do is identify the psychological condition of the peoples we want to influence, create therapeutic media environments in which to influence them, and then test them to see if they have in fact been influenced. And this is Bateson's idea written into American foreign policy. It's simply astonishing. It's just incredible. But it is exactly what we see ourselves living with now. You know, we are free on Google to select from among options that have been generated for us, and our selection process itself will be monitored and used then to reshape the environment through which we move. And we are constantly encouraged, as we encounter those environments, to remain individual, to seek self-fulfillment as opposed to, for example, political unity or institutional growth, and then to come back for more. It's enormously frustrating. One other thing I want to piece together here that I think is especially important. In the 1950s, as we expanded the democratic surround overseas, we began to promote not only American psychology, but American consumerism. We would send American products and goods abroad, famously in Moscow in 1959, along with our multimedia environments. What got lost along the way, and really disappeared in the 60s in many ways, was the political roots of this kind of turn, the anti-racism, the pro-sexual diversity, the kind of vision of a politically liberated society. What melted up instead, what sort of bubbled up from below instead, was a vision that is the one we inhabit now, very self-centered, narcissistic, consumerist, and oriented toward modes of kind of hyper-individuation in spaces built for us by distant others, many commercial, some state. And I find that piece enormously painful. It's in part because of that turn that we live more individually isolated, less politically engaged, and less tolerant lives than we might.
Yeah, it's funny. It really resonates with a disappointment and really a sadness and even an anger that I've felt over the last 5 to 10 years. Because, you know, as you know, I've gone down some of the same byways mm-hmm. you did for your cyber culture mm-hmm. book, and in some ways was writing out of the same thing when I started writing about the emerging internet back yep. in the early 1990s. I was very influenced by the countercultural ethos, and that's really the level that I tuned in on it. And so I always had some of my suspicions, was quite enthusiastic about some of the intermingling of these countercultural and cybercultural memes. And now we've reached a point where to me the story that you tell so fully in the cyberculture book is so obvious now. It's so clear to me how the ideas and dreams, both collective and individual, that are associated with the counterculture have been absorbed, reframed, redeployed within what I see as an increasingly troubling, increasingly disturbing and problematic kind of cyber consumerism. And it's really been rough for me, because I see that as the ideas that you covered in your book, and partly because of your book, become more available, and more people start going, huh, isn't it funny that Google and Apple both come out of the Bay Area, and the guys from Google like to go to Burning Man, that it's becoming really clear the way that these things have transformed. And it's very sad, because it allows some people to write off the whole idea, just as somebody could read the Bateson quote and go, see, the whole attempt to build a democratic personality was rotten and manipulative from the start. No, it's much more complicated than that. But at the same time, people who have that reaction have some degree of justification, just as people say, see, the whole hippie thing was just totally bunk. All it did was lead to, you know, surveillance by, you know, Apple when you use your computer. So it's a very disheartening story in some ways, what you tell, though illuminating, because you can see the potential so closely to mm-hmm. the things that become more degenerate. I don't know what the word is. You know, what the less than they could have been in terms of how this gesture towards freedom and tolerance and diversity gets sort of captured right. by consumerism and to some degree surveillance.
So let me return to a more hopeful moment. One of the things that I've always admired in your work and try to create in my own is a hopeful orientation. You know, I work on the counterculture and I work on these democratic moments because I long for a more democratic, countercultural way of living in my own life. And I want to return to a moment that's really sort of my favorite year in the century now. It's 1948. 1948 is a year when the countercultural possibilities are wide open, but they're not yet divorced from political projects. So Charles Morris, who's one of my heroes in the book, he's a philosopher, he writes a book called The Open Self in 1948. And the open self is a self that is the new American ideal. It's a democratic ideal. It's sexually diverse. He calls for the coexistence of ectomorphs and endomorphs, which at his time is code for straight people, gay people, and everything in between. It's a moment when Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict are calling for a racially diverse America, for allowing premarital sex. And it's also a moment at which many Americans are, believe it or not, willing to turn over control of their own military to a world government, to the United Nations. That's a world where, you know, folks who've just come through a devastating war collectively imagine an alternative and begin to think about different political structures to make that alternative happen. Now, it didn't work out then, but it's an enormously powerful vision, and it's a vision that takes us out of the old dichotomy of either we need a kind of, you know, it's either fascism or radical anarchy. It's either top-down government and or counterculture. That's a dichotomy that I think has frustrated our thinking, certainly mine, for the last 10 or 20 years. I think there's a third way, and not a third way in the Tony Blair sense, but a third way that embraces the political ideals of what we used to call the New Left and the countercultural lifestyle ideals, the self-orientation of the counterculture, and brings those two together. There's a thing that Margaret Mead says in the book, which I really, really like. I spent a lot of time in Margaret Mead's papers, and she said something that I'd like to just read if I could, because I think it's so powerful. She says, "Were the world we dream of actually attained, members of that new world would be so different from ourselves that they would no longer value it in the same terms in which we now desire it. we would no longer be at home in such a world. We who have dreamed it could not live in it. And I think that's right. And that may be the way that it works out for folks like you and me. We may get to try to dream worlds that we don't get to inhabit. But the work of dreaming them is still, I think, immodestly important.
No, that's a really wonderful point. I want to ask you a question about some of the democratic values that you talk about. Certainly, mm-hmm. Racial tolerance, tolerance for sexual diversity, a certain kind of, you know, let everybody get their freak on, et cetera, et cetera. And we can see that those ideas, you know, very comfortably sitting in a kind of, you know, creepier form of quote-unquote democratic management that mm-hmm. really in our day also increasingly serves a kind of transnational global elite that isn't really interested in democracy, so to speak. Like, it's almost the bread and circuses we get
yep.
is this kind of diversity. So how to recover? So I suspect like you sometimes, even moments of breakthrough where I should be exulting, let's like gay marriage, you know, where mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, this is obviously it's great. I've been one of those people. Gay people never freak me out. Even when I was a little kid, I was like, what? I've never understood that intolerance. So it's always just puzzled me, and it's a great relief that my gay friends increasingly are able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And yet my joy is honestly somewhat tempered by the sense that this too is in a way a kind of distraction or a kind of, you know, sop that's thrown to us. And maybe my thinking is too dark on this matter, but I suspect that sometimes you find yourself in a similar situation. And I'm wondering how you have come to think about sort of re-energizing some of these progressive goals, democratic goals, in light of the way in which they're also, you know, kind of they fit too easily into a certain way of a certain idea of control that's dominant
yeah.
now.
Yeah, I very much feel that, and you may not like my solutions, and I certainly don't always like where I've turned on this. So I grew up in the wake of the '60s, believing that creating a world in which every individual could pursue their own mode of self-fulfillment was the ideal. I didn't know that Eric Fromm, the psychologist, had in fact suggested that that should be everyone's ideal in 1947, or that that was a major theme in the 1940s. But knowing that now, fine. I'm distressed to see that the pursuit of self-satisfaction at the individual level and the building of kind of social movements around that has left us on the progressive left, I would argue, without the habit of organizing ourselves and of working in the institutional spaces that make reaching across divides possible, even though they're so difficult. So it's one thing to call for individual tolerance. You be you, I'll be me, that's all good. But when we do that, we don't have to reach across and actually embrace people who are very different than us, or let alone work with them. We're free to just let them be them and us be us. The more difficult challenge, and the challenge that the Americans of the 1940s really faced when they faced up against fascism, was how do you build a unity out of radical disagreeing diversity, not just racial diversity, different sexual preferences, but radically different political ideals, ideas of what it means to be at home, a family, a community. How do you work across that? Now, my own sense has been to become enormously frustrated with a notion that I think also comes from this time, that if we simply pursue our self-growth and express it, we will become free to build this new world. I think that's wrong. I think that we've been enormously ineffective in that dimension. We may have reframed the debate. You know, we've come up with terms like the 99%, but we've become unable to do the kind of organizing work that actually changes the political landscape, gay marriage or particularly targeted ideas notwithstanding. The group that I see doing that or has done that very effectively in the last 5 or 7 years, though it pains me enormously, is the Tea Party.
Yeah.
I see them working at the grassroots in a collaborative, institutional way. They are not afraid of institution building. And I think that one of the legacies of the self-centered approach that the counterculture has taken in our society has rendered us vulnerable precisely to the kind of management, the kind of bait-and-switch stuff that we see in the media world today, and made us less inclined to go out and do the hard work of institution building that actually could change the circumstances we inhabit.
Yeah, I think a lot of conversations come around to that again. And one thing you talk about in the book that we haven't had as much time to talk about as I would like, you mentioned John Cage, and is really the way that that art and music and performance and happenings, collective artistic environments, that mm-hmm. they really played a role in creating the situation. What kind of, or you know, of propagating this idea of the democratic self, and in some sense producing it. I mean, I think
Absolutely.
That I am myself a product in some sense of this strategy.
And oh, my.
Page, you know, and we it's shaped us. Do you see as central a role for art in this new work of building collectivities, or is it almost precisely that the lure of creative expression has become too great and we really have to kind of move in a somewhat different direction?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. I'll tell you what I'll tell you what my gut says. My gut says there's absolutely a role for art alongside organizing and as a form of organizing. I don't think there's a role for art as agitprop or simple expression. In the story I tell in this book, the happenings, the Cagean performances, become the basis of what was called in 1966 the be-in, and the be-in in turn becomes the basis of the 1967 Golden Gate Park human be-in that in many ways kicks off the psychedelic counterculture here in the Bay Area. In that time, art had an organizing force, a political force. I would love to see art have a political force like that again. You know, we see a lot of art right now, like Jeff Koons' giant inflatable dogs, that sort of snarkily comments on the power of commerce. What I don't yet see is a kind of art that offers us different organizing possibilities. I would love to see that kind of art.
Yeah, very good. Well, we only have a couple minutes left here, and I wanted to squeeze in one little question about your process. Is that your books are very carefully woven, and they really show the personal connections and the institutional connections that make these changes. You know, John Cage knew this guy, and then he became friends with Marshall McLuhan, and they had a correspondence, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you do a lot of archive work. Do you think that we're in some ways we're living in an archive age where people don't know what to do, so they just make better archives or collect more things or sort of try to organize them. Do you think our archives are underused in this attempt to come up with answers for where we are? Is there sort of a kind of potential there that we don't really know what to do with yet?
Absolutely, but I think it's a little different than what we think. The reason I focus so hard on the people involved in the stories is something I learned as a journalist. You know, at the end of the day, I think we need to hold people accountable for their historical actions. And I think with archives, as we've tended to use them, they're too often used to mine images or attitudes or tones or little bits of sound that can be incorporated into other songs. What we don't do enough of is looking back through archives to the social networks that built them, to seeing who did what, and holding them accountable, both for the parts of the world that we loathe and the parts of the world that we love. And I think that's the work of good history, is to go back there and find those folks. And that, in turn, lets us maybe recognize some of the folks who are doing the work we admire today, not just to see it as image, not just to see it as expression, but to see it as something that real living people do in the middle of their lives in complicated ways with the help of their friends and lovers.
That's really wonderful. I can see some possibility for that in the way that I think that the way in which we're interested in social networks now is part of an evolution and a maturation of the idea of social networks, and that some of the idiocy and excessive narcissism and kind of high school behavior that's associated with social networks is going to graduate into something more sophisticated and hopefully more engaged, and that might be sort of the seeds of what you're talking about, because from that level, what you're saying makes total sense. We're talking about social networking, but in a very concrete, very human, sort of literal kind of way.
Mm-hmm. And I think that we have a choice with networks. I think that the challenge with a network is, how do you grow from a network to an institution, and how do you network with those with whom you fundamentally disagree? You know, we're in the habit of finding like-minded others and hanging with them. That's great. But we won't be able to change the world until we can reach out to folks who are not like ourselves and build institutions that distribute resources equitably across all groups.
Well, that's wonderful, man. I think we're going to have to end right there.
Fred, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric. Really lucky to be here.
Okay, so Fred Turner's The Democratic Surround. It's a wonderful book. Check it out. And we'll wrap it up here. So keep your minds open.